Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer-director Adam Stovall about his debut feature, A Ghost Waits, a film that made its world premiere at Glasgow Fright Fest back in March, before all the madness kicked off. We talk a bit about that premiere and the positive reaction it received at the fest. We also get into the very interesting story of how the production came together on a shoestring budget and how Adam managed to balance being the writer, director, producer, and editor of the film. Plus, we get into Adam's curious journey into filmmaking, which saw him go from film journalism to film production, and not to mention a diversion into sketch comedy before reaching his debut directing gig. Plus, we have much, much more in an interview. It's a very fun interview, and we can't wait for you to hear it. But quickly before then, I would just like to say to all New Horror Express listeners that I hope that you are all staying safe and well and coronavirus free. As well as that, I just want to give you a quick reminder that the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. But now, on to the interview with Adam. Hi, Adam. Good to have you on New Horror Express.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. This is great.
So, we're here to talk about your film, A Ghost Waits.
Yes.
Firstly, for the listeners, can you give a little synopsis about A Ghost Waits?
Sure. Jack works for a real estate company. His job is cleaning up and fixing up recently vacated rental units to get them ready to rent again. He is sent to a particularly troubled property. They can't seem to keep anybody in it. People break their lease constantly. And so while he's cleaning it and fixing things, he's asked to kind of figure out why this happens, and he soon discovers that it happens because it's haunted, and he flees, but then thinks, oh, I have a job to do, and sticks around and starts talking to the ghost and asking questions about what it's like to be a ghost. And she is frustrated by this, but eventually they kind of come to an understanding and a mutual attraction, and yeah, things go from there.
And what was the initial inspiration behind the movie? It's quite an unusual concept, an unusual take on the whole haunted house movie subgenre.
Well, the very first step was a desperate need to make a movie. You know, this started, McLeod Andrews, who's the lead actor and my producing partner in Rebecca Films, he and I had spent a year trying to make another movie, and we couldn't raise enough money. And so after a year doing that, I had gone home to Cincinnati, Ohio. I grew up just south of it, Northern Kentucky, but I went back to kind of figure out what my next steps were. While I was back, my friends, Brian and Jen Price, I'm not a video gamer, but they are, and they had a game that they wanted me to play. It's called PT, which is a first-person haunted house puzzle game designed by Guillermo del Toro and Hideo Kojima, that is a PT stands for playable trailer or playable teaser. But basically, if you solve the puzzle, then you get this full trailer for their Silent Hill game that they were designing, which never happened. But it's really cool. It's fun. It's PT I'm talking about. You know, you walk down this L-shaped hallway, and you have to do certain things each time you walk through it in order to open up a door. And it's very atmospheric. I interviewed Guillermo del Toro years ago when I was a film journalist, and one of the things he told me was that in his house, his office, his writing room, has windows where it's always raining outside. It's always a dark and stormy night. And that is very present in this game. It is a dark and stormy night, and there's a ghost in there with you, and radio saying crazy things. But so I was playing this, and while I was doing that, I had Brian and Jen just in stitches. They were laughing so hard, and like Jen pulled out her phone and started recording me. And I had the thought then, you know, there might be a movie and a guy like me having to deal with a haunted house. And then as I was kind of playing with that idea, I saw a webcomic called Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal where man and a woman are talking. Man asks the woman, what does she think is the most American film? And she says, Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters, really? And she said, yeah, here's a movie where you have demonstrable proof of an afterlife. And the whole thing is about growing a small business and navigating government bureaucracy. Yeah, like that's hilarious. But I want to see that movie. And so I wrote it. That gave me, those two things kind of gave me like, okay, this is the story I want to tell. This is the world I want to explore. And the one of the investors that we had met when we were trying to make the other movie for a year was very excited to make something. And so he was talking to a mutual friend, Nick Thurkettle, who is how we had met him. This is MF Thomas, my executive producer. And he was talking to Nick, and Nick, you know, he's like, what's Adam up to? And Nick said, oh, I think he just had this like weird haunted house idea. And so I hopped on with MF Thomas, and I walked him through what the story, like what the movie would be. And he said, okay, I can give you this amount of money. And it's small, but you know, more than I can get my hands on normally. And my mom had said, you know, I said for a while, when you have a number, when you know, like we have an exact number that you can give us, you know, let her and her husband know. And if they can help, they will. And so I called and said, this is the number, you know, this is what we have. If you can match it, I can make a movie. And a couple of days later, she called back. I was at Plum Street Cafe with Brian Price again, in downtown Cincinnati. And she called and she said, yes, we can do that number. We can match it. And I had a budget for my first film, and I didn't have a script. So then I had to set about writing the thing while also, you know, navigating casting and meeting with, you know, department heads and whatnot. Like, it was it's a fascinating experience, yeah.
Yeah. You said there that one of the things when you were playing that game, PT, the kind of one of the initial inspirations was, what if a guy like me, how would a guy like me navigate a haunted house? How is the character of Jack in any way autobiographical, or is it just taking inspiration?
It is fairly autobiographical in that I have been a maintenance man professionally, in that I struggle with depression and feelings of extreme loneliness. And also, his musical taste is my musical taste. it was really interesting to write Jack because I wrote it for McLeod. You know, I to the point that if he had said no, this movie just wouldn't exist. The point of making this, one of the points of making this, was to work with my best friend.
But he was always going to play the character of Jack.
Absolutely. No one else would play that character. Like I said, if he'd said no, we shut it down. We just find something else to do. And I'm not somebody who, you know, oh, I want to make movies with my friends. I'm not that person. I want to make movies with fellow artists. But as a first-time filmmaker, and as somebody starting, you know, on this career, I want to work with people who know more than I did. And currently, that's a pretty low bar. But I feel like I should be the least informed person on set because I wrote it and I'm directing it and it's very much from my heart. So if everyone else understands the various disciplines at a level far beyond my own understanding, then when they're asking me questions, all I have to do is answer honestly and it will be, it will maintain a consistency. That's how I kind of viewed my job.
So you told us about how you got the budget for the movie and you said you had a budget, you didn't have a script. You had a concept, but so how quickly did that come about? How quickly did the script come about, and how quickly did it go from script into production?
So I would say I had started working on the script. I had started writing on the project in December 2015. And it had a different ending at that time and fewer characters. And I'd gone down to Austin to visit my sister and a friend for the holiday, for Christmas. And the first night I stayed with my friend, and he had a bunch of movies to show me. And after the first one, I was like, hey, if we can take a break for a second, I'm working on this thing, and the ending isn't quite right. Can you help me? And so we talked about it for a few hours, and he kind of gave me the idea, the idea of introducing Rosie, the younger ghost, for a sort of all about Eve dynamic, as he said. And once that happened, then, there's this thing that kind of bonds Jack and Muriel. Maybe this is a love story. And so, I returned to Cincinnati and kept writing. And I guess the summer of 2015, the band The Bang Synths were in Cincinnati workshopping a show called 100 Days. And my then girlfriend and I had gone to see it. And it's a great show. The Bang Synths are just incredibly talented musicians. But so one night, spring of 2016, I don't remember exactly when now, but she and I were out, we were talking about something, and I just said, oh my God, I have it. I know the ending. I had in my mind the garage and the song Years Go By playing under it. And that gave, now I know how this ends. And my general feeling about writing is that your ending is your point. I think it's a problem in a lot of modern cinema, especially independent cinema, that you have an idea, which is your hook in your first act, but they don't always have a point. So you have a lot of movies that like grab you right off the bat, but then kind of peter out. Whereas we had the opposite, where I knew my point, and I wasn't sure how I was going to get there. So, the first quarter, the first half, because we shot in August 2016. We were originally going to shoot in April 2016 and then had to push for reasons that I don't remember. So I was just writing as I went. And I was just like, I'd have the idea, and it was just like, I'm just going to write placeholder dialogue. And it didn't feel right to me. So then it became like, all right, well, what do I want to say? If this is the ending, and this is kind of the North Star that we're aiming the ship at, what do I want to do between here and there? And so it was just a lot of writing for the first half of that year. But then even after we shot it, and she broke up with me 2 weeks later, and I took some time off to just feel things. When I dove back in, I also edited the movie, and I taught myself to editing the movie. And in doing that, I cut together the assembly cut, which was an hour and 50 minutes, 150. And the movie is now 79 minutes and 11 seconds. So it was a bit different. But I looked at the assembly cut and I thought, oh shit, I think I've made a bad movie. But the ending always worked. And so then it just became, well, let's get to the ending quicker. And slowly scenes started taking shape. And eventually got to a point from minute 34 on was good. It worked, but we didn't earn the first 33. And so we went back to we did some reshoots April 2017. We did 4 days, and that was that's kind of, the idea of this scene was good, but the way it's executed isn't, let's figure that out. But that was just McLeod and me. We couldn't afford to bring anybody else back. We did a week and figured out, the ending is going to feature this montage, because the way that the opening now is cut together is different than what I had imagined. And so the ending needs to change so that it feels a bit more like we intended to do it this way, to feel a bit more symmetrical, which matters a lot to me. And so we did this, and we went back and cut the footage in, and it's like, oh my God, this is so much better. It's not totally there, And, you know, we showed it to a lot of friends and family, and we're getting notes. And at one point, we had planned to meet up to work together on the cut for a week. And we were talking about a particular note, and I was in the middle of defending it. Like, no, but, like, this is what the scene does. Oh, it doesn't do that. Oh, we need to do another reshoot. So we went back to Cincinnati for another, like, 4 days. And so the writing, I generally say it takes me, like, 3 years to write something. And even in the case of this, where I had the money before I had a script, and then I wrote the script in 6 months so that we could shoot it, it still took me 3 years to write the thing because, you know, we're there doing that second set of reshoots, and it's like, well, what does the scene do? The dreams, the first two dreams used to be very different, and they just didn't work. So the second dream is the last thing we shot because it was the hardest thing for us to get our heads around what how to do that. Because I refuse to scrap the dreams because it buys us that last one. And it was so important for me that we have that third dream. It's like, no, we have to make this work. So in fact, we had set up to shoot it. We found a new space in the house that we'd been shooting in for years and yet somehow hadn't seen this unfinished attic. So like, dude, like what else are you holding out on us? But we went to shoot, well, because it's unfinished, there was it started raining, and that was all you could hear because there's no insulation. So we had to go back because it was going to stop raining first thing in the morning. So we had to go back at 6 a.m. to shoot that scene so that McLeod can make an 11 a.m. flight back to L.A. And that was when we were done writing.
Wow. Were the shoots themselves difficult? Was there any on-set disasters or anything like that? I mean, obviously, I know it's obviously spread out and you needed to do the two sets of reshoots, which is obviously has its own complications, but how smooth was the shooting process generally?
It was relatively smooth. You know, considering we shot a feature film for less than the cost of a base level Mercedes, you know, the house that we were shooting in, it was August 2016, and there was a heat wave, and the house didn't have air conditioning. So the guy who owned the house, he had been lent a window unit from someone in his church. We rented another window unit, air conditioning unit, put in a window. And then we had fans running. And so we were constantly tripping the circuit breaker. And like the lights would go out, and I would just run downstairs and reset everything to the point that like if anyone ever forgot to say striking, if I saw a light go out, even if other lights were on, I just immediately would run and people were like, no, Adam, you don't, like, I was just turning off a light. It's like, well, then you have to say striking because I'm so accustomed to tripping this damn circuit breaker. But it was such a small crew. I mean, we had a crew of, I want to say six. And so they're really, you know, I mean, everybody had a lot of, you know, stress. There was a lot of pressure to get it right without a lot of help and without a lot of resources. But we also didn't make it needlessly complicated. You know, it's a very simply shot movie. It's a very, you know, there's one effect in it, and that's something that McLeod and I did. Madeline, you know, she and I talked about what the makeup design would be. Mike and I were able to meet one time to kind of talk about how it would look. And it wasn't intended to be in black and white, actually, but that was a decision that I made later on. And I love black and white anyway, so I'm very happy that it is, because if I only ever get to make one black and white movie, at least I got to make one.
Was one of the things I was going to ask about, actually. I was wondering if that had been a budgetary decision or an artistic decision. I was, you know, thinking of things like Clerks. It was like, yeah, we, you know, that's what we had.
Right. Yeah, the answer is both. You know, very early on, I was on a location scout with my UPM. And I told her, like, yeah, I've been thinking about making it in black and white. And she said, no, absolutely not. Don't do that. We shot it in color. And we had planned for it to be in color. We also shot with two different cameras. The Blackmagic Ursa Mini, which is a 4K, and the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema, which is a digital 16. And not only that, but Michael Potter, who's a really talented cinematographer in Cincinnati, he shot principal photography. So the 2 weeks that we shot in August 2016, whereas I shot the pickups. And two different cameras, two different shooters, it just became impossible to match everything. And I drove myself crazy trying to. I was handling color correction and just, I was losing it. And McLeod one day said, have you thought about just making it black and white? I said, I have thought about that. Let's try it. And so we just dropped a LUT on it, a black and white LUT. And it felt so right. You know, it felt appropriate aesthetically, thematically, and tonally. You know, I like old horror. And this is definitely much more classic horror than modern horror, I think. The Old Dark House or The Uninvited. That's kind of where my heart lives. Mm-hmm. And so doing that, and then just, it just felt, I mean, we watched it and we were like, yep, yeah, this is how this should look. And it's funny because, like, you know, now, I mean, it's not the most economically wise decision. Plenty of people are just like, we don't really do black and white movies. But it's also such a low budget film that it's like, well, you know, we don't really have like that high a bar to cross in terms of making our money back. And again, like if this is the only time we get to do this, then let's do it. One thing that I noticed in a lot of interviews that I would read or listen to with directors was people saying, you know, about their first film, like, oh, if we'd known what we were doing, we never would have done that. I took that as like, it's not a, don't make these mistakes. It's you have one chance to make these mistakes. Like, I have one movie to do this on, because you learn so much having made a movie. But it's like, yeah, once you've made a movie and you're making a second one, you're expected to know what you're doing. So it's at least to an extent that you're not on the first one.
Talking about that process of making mistakes, I was wondering if you were at all intimidated diving directly into making a feature film. You know, a lot of the debut feature film directors I've talked to on the podcast have made at least two or three shorts. Not all of them have. A couple of them have done what you've done and just dived straight in and made a feature film. What was that process like for you?
So I attempted to make a short film a year or two before we made this one. And it just fell apart in spectacular fashion. Details I won't go into here, but I realized, like, okay, I'm going to have to borrow money. I'm going to have to raise money to make a film. And I feel it's irresponsible to raise money to get investments for a short film, because there's no way to monetize that. Now, I do not want to diminish the importance of a short film. I think they're very important. When I have a learning experience to go through, it definitely helps to have, or I've learned to appreciate having kind of a low stakes or no stakes environment in which to make mistakes or in which to learn. But in the case of this, I felt it would be irresponsible to raise money for a short. And so I thought, well, if I have to do this anyway, like, let's just make a feature. And I worked a few years ago on a movie that they thought they were going to have a much larger budget than they did. And I ended up having a much larger job on it than I was supposed to, because people kept leaving the production. But what it did was give me front row seats to how an independent film is made, you know, where money has to go versus where money has gone out of habit. And so when it came time to make this, I was like, all right, it's a feature, but it needs to cost what a short would cost. So we're minimizing locations. We're going to call in every favor we have, and we're going to promise favors to people. We're going to minimize speaking roles. You know, we're never going outside if we can help it. There are no group shots. Like, it was very clarifying. And so to make a feature right off the bat, instead of doing a short first, you know, I feel like I just would have been, so much of getting older is learning how your brain works. I might have appreciated an environment that was where there was less stress, but at the same time, that stress and that pressure of, I need to make this movie, I need to finish this movie, I have investors that I need to get their money back. Like, it was so much work, and so much of that work was alone. You know, I edited this on my own. It was so much time just spent alone at a desk with my laptop that I kind of needed that pressure to keep me moving forward, that I couldn't put this down. It was not allowed.
Yeah. How difficult was it balancing all the different hats you have to wear? I mean, you look at the IMDb for this film, and you are the writer, director, editor, producer. You do some additional camera. You make a cameo to work at the end. You know, like
yeah. That's another thing of trying to minimize expenditures. I am Neil in the movie because that meant I didn't have to cast anyone to be Neil. I edited the movie because I couldn't afford to hire somebody. You know, now I also love it, and like, it has, I joke that this has ruined movies for me in terms of watching movies, because now it's like, oh yeah, the framing, or you know, whatever. I see all the work happening around it, but it's also enriched my enjoyment of films, because now, like, I remember watching Creed 2, and I love Creed, and Creed 2 is not Creed, but at the end, when it builds to its climax, like, I felt like I could see the filmmaker in the editing bay, seeing it all come together and just jumping up and down saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I'm a much more sympathetic viewer, unless I can't tell why you made it. Because making a movie is so hard, and so many people have to wake up early. Like, if you don't have a point, then I get kind of upset. But other than that, like, no, I get how hard this is. And I get that, like, for most of us, you know, I don't think you can fall into making movies, especially not directing movies. I think those of us who are fortunate enough to become filmmakers, it's because it's all we want to do. And so I've talked about this a little bit elsewhere, but like, this was very much a make it or break it situation for me at the time of filming. I was at one of my lowest points. I struggle with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation. I have my entire life. And it had really built to a fever pitch, to where I felt like I might be an existential mistake, like I wasn't supposed to be in the universe, and that's why there wasn't a place for me in the universe. And so making this was like, well, I don't have a backup plan, so I'm going to make a movie and see if I can. And if I can't, then, like, you know, I don't know what comes next, but I don't think it's good, or at least acceptable. So doing all of these jobs was just like, whatever gets it done, whatever gets us across the finish line. Do I need to shoot some stuff? Okay, well, I know how to frame. I know how to make sure I'm in focus. That's why so much is locked down as well. If I'm editing, okay, well, I understand rhythm, you know, so let's basically learn how to edit, and then I'll find the rhythm of the piece. All of it was just things that I had a hunch I could do. We did end up hiring a colorist, because turns out color correction, not something I can do. We brought Ari in, and like, just for 2 days, he gave us a really great deal because he dug the movie. And so for 2 days, I just sat in his Brooklyn apartment and watched him work magic. It was amazing. And it really, I don't want to edit any other movies that I make, because I want to sit with someone whose discipline that is. Like, I've been writing for 20 years, screenplays. I've been writing my entire life, but I've been writing screenplays for 20 years. I want to work with people who have been shooting for decades, who have been cutting for decades, who have been, you know, recording sound for decades, people that I can really learn from, and that I can kind of take credit for their amazing choices.
This is something of a side question, but do you think there's a kind of catharsis to horror that might attract a certain type of person? Because, like, you're talking very openly there about your depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation, and I've had similar issues that have dogged my life. I, you know, I'm in a happy place in my life right now, but like, I've had crises, and you know, I've talked to other people in the podcast. It's been one of the themes of the podcast. People, anxiety has come up a bunch of times. Do you think there's any connection, or is it just that there's a lot of anxiety in the world and a lot of, you know, like, it's just a very common thing, and maybe more common than most people.
I think there's absolutely a connection. On one, you know, for one thing, genre storytelling, be it horror, be it sci-fi, be it action, whatever, allows for a more operatic style of storytelling. One of the best pieces of advice I've ever been given was film is an emotional medium. You can impart all the information to the audience you want, but if you don't give them a reason to care, they won't, and it will all be for naught. So I think it's all, you know, it's an operatic story or style that also requires a strong metaphor. I think you're able to say things in horror that you can't say. Like, I remember Ari Aster saying that if Hereditary weren't a horror film, if it was just a family drama, no one would make it. There's room to tell these stories. And the other thing, the reason for that being the audience of horror, people who are attracted to it, it's just the most beautiful community. They're so welcoming and warm and loving. And if you're not in the club, you might look at it and think, like, these people who spend all their time watching, like, girls get hacked up and, like, babies get possessed and whatnot, like, they're loving and warm. It's like, well, yeah, because they're misfits. They are people who grew up not feeling a part of society, who felt very cast aside, who felt like there wasn't a place for them. And they, you know, whatever it was about the storytelling of horror resonated, and they bought a black t-shirt with, you know, a horror symbol on it, and they went somewhere where someone else saw it and said, oh my God, I love that movie.
Yeah.
And, like, that's what it is. It's, you know, if you go to a horror film festival, oh my God, the hugs are amazing. You know, I said after mine, I was like, please, like, I love hugs. I also like drinks. Feel free to give me one of those. But, like, you know, which, you know, in the midst of a global pandemic, I probably shouldn't have opened myself up to hugs, but everything seems to be okay right now. But yeah, like, they're just really warm and beautiful people who so appreciate somebody who wants to talk to them, who wants to tell a story to them, you know, because especially now, I mean, Marvel and all the Disney brands and whatnot, like, if you love comic books, you have won. The entire culture tends to you. But, like, even though we're going through kind of a golden age of horror, especially independent horror, it still gets that ghettoization of, yeah, but it's horror. And it's almost, you know, when you think about, like, how many actors came out of soap operas, and it's like, well, yeah, because they sharpen their tools in a genre where the storytelling demanded them, they've got to take some ridiculous material and sell it, you know? And there's a lot of crossover there. You know, there are some ridiculous horror movies that completely work because the cast is giving it their all and they feel real. I think these are the reasons why people who struggle with mental health, social disorders, etc., really find a home in this world.
I think that absolutely nails it on the head there. You know, it's very much like that for me as well. I think that's what I fell into both horror and metal, and for very similar reasons of just like that sense of community and belonging.
Well, and metal has an interesting parallel because really, like, really well executed horror is just pure cinema. You know, you look at the Babadook and there's so much just pure cinema happening. And metal is similar in that, like, it's so hard to do well and write. There's so much going on. You know, when I think about Sunbather by Death Heaven, like, there's so much happening. And if you're not aware, like, it just washes over and you're like, I don't know, it's music, it's not really my thing. And it's like, yeah, the intricacy of it is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great album. To segue back into kind of your story, was directing always the dream then? You've obviously taken an interesting path that has covered film journalism, speech writing, sketch comedy, you know, but was directing the thing, the dream?
I think so. It's interesting. I knew that I wanted to be a part of movies. I knew I wanted to have a hand in making them. Because when I was little, they meant a lot to me. And it took me a minute. Like, I would watch Backdraft. I was like, oh, I want to be a fireman. I watch Navy SEALs. I want to be a Navy SEAL. And at some point, you just realize, like, oh, no, I just want to work in movies. You know, my entire life, I've watched a lot of movies. I come by very honestly. My dad worked as a projectionist all through college. My mom loves movies. Now she and my aunt see at least one a week. Well, not right now, obviously, because they can't. But typically. And so I grew up watching a lot. I was a comedy nerd too. Like, I watched a lot of movies. I watched a lot of sitcoms. I watched a lot of stand-up comedy. I loved that stuff. And directing, I didn't quite get to until I was in high school. But writing, I understood writing. And I also, because I was a creative kid, because I was a lonely kid for the most part. And so I would play with my action figures and just make up stories, and whether it was like making up a new story in the Star Wars universe or whatever. But like, and then when I got into school, I would write a lot of stories, because around the time I was in school, Kentucky passed this thing where you had to have a portfolio. And one of the options, like, you know, was a short story. So if I didn't have anything else in the class, I would just write a short story about something that we dealt with. And so it was always kind of the thing I could fall back on, or it's how I processed the world. And then when I was in high school, I saw Pulp Fiction. I saw it in theaters. And that blew my mind. That Pulp Fiction showed me, it showed me that cinema was a lot more elastic than I thought it was. Growing up in a small suburb in Northern Kentucky, I got whatever movies everyone got. The Criterion Collection was not a thing in Erlanger, Kentucky. I would go to Video America and kind of pick up whatever there was. But then Pulp Fiction was like, oh, I need to, like, tell me more about this French New Wave. And so as I got into that, it's like, oh, okay, this is what directing is. But I still had to kind of work my way to it. Writing, I had a good deal of confidence that I could write. And even though I spent about 15 years trying to do anything else, because in interviews, filmmakers always say, if you could be happy doing something else, do that. And so I worked in politics, and I ran bars and restaurants, and I even did door-to-door sales for a very short amount of time and was truly horrible at it. But when I was 29 years old, my dog died. She was 16 years old, and towards the end, it was just a one-bedroom apartment, me and her, and I would come home. I worked third shift, and I would come home and watch whatever I'd recorded for the night before, and she would generally just walk around the apartment or sleep on my bed, but if I was watching Friday Night Lights, she would crawl up next to me and put her head on my leg and watch it with me. And so the first time I watched Friday Night Lights after she died, I thought, it really put into stark relief how alone I was, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. And so I sold as much of my stuff as I could, and I moved across the country to Los Angeles. I had also been in a pretty severe depression for about 4 years. I weighed about 350 pounds. I was basically trying to kill myself through just lack of maintenance. Let's see how much, if I just drink nothing but Pepsi, let's see if I can become gelatinous. And so when I moved to Los Angeles, I thought, well, if I move 2,500 miles and just sit in my room, I'm going to feel pretty stupid. So, while I was working third shift, I would listen to a lot of podcasts, and the Creative Screenwriting Podcast was my favorite. So I, went to a screening, and the guy who ran it, I said, hey, do you need help? And so I started volunteering in the Creative Screenwriting Podcast. I did that for a few months. And then, one day, you know, we were wrapping everything up and putting everything away in his van. And he said, would you like to write an article? And it was this tiny movie that nobody saw, but I'd been reading that magazine for so long that I knew how to write an article for him. So I did the interview, wrote the article, and passed the audition. And the second movie I covered was The Hurt Locker, because no one knew what that was going to be. And so I did that for years, eventually becoming an editor, a contributing editor at the magazine. And that was a lot of fun. It was a great film school because I got to talk to working filmmakers, and I had an hour. I had as much time as I wanted generally to ask them every question I had. And I didn't have all the time in the world for all of them. I interviewed J.J. Abrams and I had about 20 minutes. But that was an amazing film school, because you read the books and it's all very theoretical. And then you can say, like, okay, well, why did this happen? And you get, you know, I think people generally want answers when they say, like, why does this happen in the movie? They want some great artistic answer. And sometimes there is that, but sometimes it's just like, I don't know, that's what was there. You know, we were fighting sunset and this is what was around, so we just used that. And that made it feel more doable to me. I could get my hands around answers like that. And so when I, when print started dying and I left, you know, the magazine became a blog and I left and decided to focus on production, that then became the film school of PAing on TV shows or becoming a second AD on a feature film. It gave me a front row seat to the various aspects of filmmaking. And so growing up in Northern Kentucky, you know, you feel like you're on Tatooine. I mean, Hollywood is a world away and it's an impossible world to traverse. And what all of this did was it started making it a lot more feasible, a lot more manageable and less mythic. And that is in fact something that I try to carry forward, you know, in interviews like this or Q&As. You know, the movie wears its low budget on both sleeves and its collar. And a large part of that is that I wanted to make something that another person could, a person like me could look at and say, well, I can do that. You know, I wanted to make a movie that didn't have all the bells and whistles, but was still a movie that's told a story and said, you can do this for less money than you think. You just have to know what, you have to know the story that you're telling. And that's one great thing about having a foundation in writing is that writing allows me to know the point of what I'm doing so that then when we get on set and I'm being asked a million questions by the cinematographer, the sound recordist and the actors and makeup and everything else, all I really have to worry about is being honest and speaking from the heart because that's where the movie is coming from.
To ping back to the movie and the filming of the movie, McLeod, who plays Jack, and Natalie, who plays the ghost Muriel, they have great chemistry on the screen. They seem natural together on screen. Did they instantly hit it off?
Yes, they met on set. We flew Natalie in from New York. We shot in Cincinnati, Ohio. We flew her in from New York, and they met on set. She came in and we did a makeup test, and we did a makeup test in the kitchen of the apartment where I was living, and we were shooting a scene with McLeod in the living room, which shared a doorway, not even a door between the two, but shared a little walkway. So, you know, we were all kind of in it together from the jump.
And talking about how natural they are, was any of it improvised at all?
Not as much as you might think. Both of them have theatrical backgrounds. Both of them like to stick to the script. Both of them are also very funny, very smart people. So they, you know, I'm not a taskmaster about the script. If, you know, please beat it if you can. And so like everybody's favorite scene, you know, when with the, in the bathroom with the toilet, that's an improv. It starts as a scripted scene. The phone call is scripted. And we had actually deleted that. We had shot it back in 2016, but I had cut it out because the scene just wasn't good to me. It didn't do what I needed it to do. And then in the process of editing, we realized, oh, we really need the information that the scene gives us. And I said, okay, well then that means we have to reshoot it because I'm not putting that footage back in. So cut a bunch of dialogue from the previous version. And so the phone call is there, but then like, it needed something more. And McLeod said, I have an idea, let the camera run, I'm gonna try something. And he made the toilet talk and I bust up laughing and we had to do another take. But both of them, Natalie, some of the footage in there, it's very funny to me. So in the middle of production, she'd had to fly back to New York to do this 24 hour theater thing, or I don't know, but it was basically like fly in, get some material, you know, run it through a bunch, stage it, you're done. And so she flew back having barely slept for like 3 days. And the first stuff we shot was some of the scenes in the kitchen when they their first really sit down and talk scene at the kitchen table. And so when that scene goes on and we drop the dialogue and it's music and we're kind of seeing them, you know, really kind of let the walls down and connect, I'd have to go back and watch the footage, the raw footage. But like, sorry, it's just made me laugh. Natalie just started singing the Men in Black song. I don't remember what prompted that. But they just had each other cracking up. So they're, the chemistry was there immediately, and it's all on them. I had so much to do on set that I did not get to spend as much time with them as I would like to have. And I hope we get to work together again so that we can collaborate a bit more fully. But because both of them have theatrical background, both of them really dug into the script. There was a lot of respect for the script on their part. And so, you know, they often didn't feel the need to change a line because they liked the line that was there. And the fact that that kind of made it a much, much more of a two-way street, where because I felt seen and respected, I wanted them to feel seen and respected. And so they could come to me with ideas. And yeah, it was just that thing of like, we all kind of are on the same page, of on the same team, of wanting this thing to be the best movie it can be. So there's not a lot of improv, but what's there generally is some of the best stuff in the movie.
Going back a little bit further than that, how did she come on board? How did Natalie come on board? And why did you cast her as Muriel? Why did you think she would be perfect in that role?
So I originally wrote the part of Muriel for a friend of mine, a very talented actor, but she got, she was cast on a TV show and was no longer available. And so I had recast with an actor local to Cincinnati. And as I said before, I think, you know, we were supposed to shoot in April. We ended up shooting in August. When we pushed the dates, she wasn't available in August. So I had been following Natalie on Twitter. She is an amazing Twitter follow, at InWalks. She's just hilarious and brilliant. I love her to death. But so she was in my mind just as like an impressive person. And I was going through Twitter, and it was in the back, you know, casting is kind of a thing that when you're casting, it just sits in the back of your head, at least for me, you know, and I kind of let, you know, it's almost like music. You know, like if I'm working on a scene, a song, you know, we'll grab onto it, and suddenly that scene is set to that song. So I was reading her Twitter, and she had posted something that was, I think, a thread. And as I was reading it, I was just like, this person is amazing. And then I thought, oh, she also acts. So I went to her website, and it didn't have a reel. And but it had her email address. And so I emailed her saying, hey, my name's Adam. I'm making a movie in Cincinnati, Ohio. This is what it's about. If you're curious, I can send you a script, but I'd like to talk to you about the female lead. And she got back to me saying, that sounds interesting. Let me see the script. And I sent her that. Cause I try not to be presumptuous. You know, if it's a first contact, I always will ask if I can send something. I never want to assume I can. But so I sent her the script, and she really dug it and got back and said, I've read this a few times now. I really like it. What do you need from me? And I said, an audition, if you can. And she self-taped a scene and was great. And the next day we hopped on FaceTime, and I offered her the role. And yeah, she was in the movie. Yeah.
fast forwarding a bit, how did the premiere at Fright Fest come about? What did they reach? Did you just submit to them, or how was that process?
Yeah, so McLeod has also done a few other movies with his friends Perry Blackshear and Evan Dumichel. They Look Like People and The Siren, and I believe both of those played Fright Fest. And so when we were sending it out to
at the Glasgow Fright Fest last year.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. There's a video on YouTube. I watched his interview. But yeah, like he's very fond of them. And so when we were submitting to festivals, he submitted us to Fright Fest. And this is actually a really fun story, I think. So we had submitted to a bunch. We were taking kind of our moonshot, you know, like, let's submit to the really huge ones that are life-changing and see what happens. And what happened was they would get back with a very long form email about, you know, thank you so much for submitting. And while this doesn't match, while this is not what we're looking for, it's by no means a statement on the quality of your project. Please keep making movies and keep submitting it to us and, you know, paying that fee. So I had gotten very good at getting rejection emails. In early November last year, my father had a stroke, and my sister, who lives in Austin, Texas, had flown up to be with him in Ohio while he dealt with all that. And I'm here in New York, and my mom was coming up because the Criterion Collection actually hosted a private screening of this movie, The Ghost Waits. And so when that was over, I said, well, I'm going to go back to Delaware with you, Mom. And that way we can hang out for a little bit in case things take a turn and I have to fly to Ohio to be with Dad. So I was in Delaware for about 2.5 weeks. And in that time, I was helping out a lot around the house, and then we would go see a movie. And so we went to see Ford versus Ferrari, and which is a really good movie, very well made. But we got out and I went to the bathroom and turned on my phone. And there were a few emails, and I opened one up, and it's from Paul McAvoy of Fright Fest saying, we really like the movie. You're in for Glasgow. And so my poor mother, who has been watching, you know, who's been observing all this stuff with my dad, just sees me come out of the bathroom, go just make a beeline right to her, hug her, and start crying. And she's like, well, this doesn't seem like a bad cry. What's happening? And it's like, we got into a festival. and that was it. That was how I learned of Fright Fest. And then in December, the documentary that was made about them posted to Prime here in the States. And my dad and I watched it and just thought, like, this seems like just such a wonderful group of people. I can't wait to meet them. They're so lovely to deal with an email. And so, yeah, that's... You know, McLeod loved it and thought that we might have a chance. And the guys at Fright Fest, you know, when you make something this small and this personal, there's a very real possibility that no one else will care. And I was ready for that. I was ready for festivals to pass, for self-distribution to be the only option. I was ready for that because I understand the movie that I made. And so to have them say, this is beautiful, we love it, we want to show it. And then to get to Glasgow and have that increase exponentially with all of them saying, you know, we love this movie. It's our favorite movie this year. All four of us agree on this. That never happens. And then to have a room full of 400 strangers, for the most part, love it. You know, people come up afterwards and they were hugging me and thanking me for the movie and telling me how much it meant to them and sharing some stuff that I won't get into here because it's entirely too personal, but really sharing some stuff that's so brave, you know, and it was just, it was that, like, it's been a very long road, but in that moment it was like, oh, this shit works. And it works for others. It doesn't just work for me. I'm still wrapping my head around how beautiful that was.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I didn't actually see it at the festival, so later when you screener, but yeah, it's a great movie, and
thank you.
It was one that got a massive positive reaction at Fright Fest. I certainly, following on Twitter, you know, when people were doing like their top three or, you know, whatever films at Fright Fest, it was generally in there, often at number one. You know, it's certainly one of the ones, along with a couple other movies, that had like the biggest buzz around it. Obviously, well, yeah, got a lot of great reactions. What, in terms of, you know, obviously some probably too personal, but in terms of the best reactions you got that you can talk about in the podcast, what were some of the best reactions you got?
One that I feel comfortable two that I feel comfortable talking about because they were shared publicly. But like, sorry. Like I said, I know what movie I made and I don't begrudge anybody not liking it. I was surprised. I am not a controversial person. I'm certainly not a provocateur. I was surprised that people felt the ending was so controversial. For those who haven't seen it, that's not going to make a lot of sense, but hopefully you'll check it out. And I'll address this specifically in a second, but like the general response, the overwhelming response from people has really, you know, I know what a hard sell a movie like this is. It's black and white, it's tiny, it costs no money, like all of that. I understand if you're, if your job is putting out movies and profiting off the act of doing so, you look at this and you think, I don't know how I can sell this. The really cool thing about that reaction is that it kind of increased my belief that this is not a trailer movie. This is not a, you know, opening weekend movie. There's a musical called Title of Show, and a song in that musical, I'd rather be nine people's favorite thing than 100 people's ninth favorite thing. This is a word of mouth movie. This is a movie that like will make people feel less alone, which is my favorite thing a movie can do. And that's what movies have done for me, is make me feel like I make a bit of sense when the rest of the world makes me feel like I don't. So the specific reactions, I woke up the next morning to someone, to a message from someone on Instagram that they let me share, basically saying, you know, I liked your movie, but like you made me feel seen and heard. And I've been, you know, I've been in a place where I was starting to feel, you know, kind of terminally alone and like there wasn't anything for me, and that you suffer that same thing and made something like this, you know, I love it and thank you for doing that. That is a truly overwhelming thing to have someone say to you. On Facebook in the Fright Fest group, someone posted a thread or started a thread about, I need to talk about the ending to A Ghost Waits, spoilers below, so anybody who hasn't seen it. But then there was a conversation, you know, about people saying like, is this in poor taste? Does this glamorize or romanticize, you know, a terrible act? And someone else who was there that night, who had come up and said a bit of this to me, she said, okay, we're just gonna have to kind of spoil it. Because I can't think of a way to say what she says without giving away. So,
right. So spoilers. Just in case listeners, if you've not seen the movie, this is the spoiler section of the podcast. And just skip over this bit until you've seen the movie and then listen to this.
Yeah. And hopefully Scott can kind of figure out the time code that you want to jump to. But so, in the end, you know, obviously he pulls his car into the garage, closes the door, and kills himself with carbon monoxide. To me, that was never a taboo thing. I didn't set out to ruin anyone's day. And I would never want to be disrespectful or insensitive to somebody who has lost someone to suicide. But I am more respectful and more sensitive to the person who they lost, who is dealing, and to the people who deal with this. And because I deal with it, I felt like I could speak to it in a way that I hadn't seen done before. So there's a few ways you can kind of look at this. In the context of the film, we establish there's an afterlife. So really, he's just moving to Denver for a girl. But also, someone who struggles with suicidal ideation, it's not this like, woe is me, you know, nobody likes me, I guess I'll just go eat worms thing. Like, my mind has a logical argument for why I don't deserve existence. That is my suicidal ideation, that I'm fighting my mind, and that it's not a thing that I like, oh, I can't do that. It's a thing that makes sense. I just know that it's not the thing that I should do, but it always exists there as a, not even an option, just like a route to take. What I wanted to do was talk about this taboo in a way that could build empathy with people who don't struggle with it, to give them an understanding of what it feels like on the inside. And so then to see people saying, he's glamorizing suicide, he's romanticizing suicide, this is in poor taste, I do not shy away from this conversation. But I also felt like I'm on vacation, because I took the week in London after the screening. I was like, I'm not gonna do this right now. And in that time, one of this woman that was at the screening responded in the thread and said, A movie won't make me kill myself. A TV show isn't going to make me kill myself. But a movie, a TV show, they'll make me feel seen and they'll make me feel heard. And maybe if we weren't so afraid of talking about this, maybe if people who don't struggle with it weren't so afraid of talking about it, then people who do struggle with it, it would be easier for us to talk about. Because right now it's such an extreme taboo that if you even mention it, people shut down the conversation. They just can't, like, oh, it's so selfish. It's not selfish. To be honest, selfishness is making someone else's death about you. This is the act of a desperate soul, and it is wallpaper. It is a room that they live in, and people need to understand that. If they truly love their friend or their family member who is dealing with this, they need to just check themselves for a second and listen, and don't listen in a prescriptive way of, oh, okay, well, you need to do this. Go for a walk. Listen and say, I'm so sorry you struggle with this. Don't make it about you. It's about that person. It is their struggle. It is their journey. And if they are brave enough to share it with you, don't tell them they need a Band-Aid. Hold their hand and tell them you love them and that they're not alone. That is why I made a movie like that.
Wow. And I think that's a beautiful, poignant moment to kind of bring the interview to an end. But just quickly before we head on out, sure. Can you tell us what you're working on next?
Yeah. So there is a script that's done called There's Nothing Outside, which is an existential horror ensemble chamber piece about a bunch of people stuck inside and stuff happens. There's a sci-fi thing that I've been working on that is a therapy session as sci-fi horror. There's a comedy that I'm doing a rewrite on for a producer. So there's, you know, we've started to get a little bit of momentum, and so people are expressing interest in making this stuff. So yeah, there's, you know, I've got one done. I've got one that rewrite that I'm finishing, and then I've got like four or five things that I'm writing on now. A true crime thing, two other horror stories. Yeah, there's always a lot going on.
And Brett, when will those come out? You know, the sci-fi horror therapy session welcome you back on the podcast. No problem at all.
Oh, that would be lovely. Thank you. And one thing that I would ask of your audience. As I mentioned before, my father had a stroke in early November. I was out of town for a while, helping with dealing with the fallout of that. And while I was out of town, someone broke into my apartment and stole my camera and sound equipment. I have a GoFundMe page that is the pinned tweet on my Twitter account, at Adam Stovall. The link is in my Instagram, not Adam S. But, you know, if people hear the story or see the movie and want to help out, that would be very much appreciated. I can't do my job without those tools.
Excellent. No problem. So we'll recommend that people do that and also check out A Ghost Waits. Thank you very much, Adam, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
That was my guest, Adam, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for joining us on this latest edition of the pod. Hopefully, it provided you with some entertaining lockdown listening. Also, remember the best way you can support the show is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Finally, be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Plus, be sure to look out for our new bonus series, New Horror Express's Guilty Pleasures, which launches in June. On the first episode of that, we will be looking at either Dracula 2000 or Argento's Dracula. Poll finishes today on that one to decide which Guilty Pleasure movie we're going to kick off this new series with. But until next time, see ya!